Our next guest on Downtown is a longtime host at Turner Classic Movies. He is a host of a couple of wonderful podcasts, The Plot Thickens and Talking Pictures, and he joins us this afternoon to help celebrate TCM's 30th anniversary. We are so happy to be joined by Ben Mankiewicz. Happy 30th anniversary to TCM.
It's pretty good. It's pretty good.
Is it safe to say that TCM viewers have a pretty unique relationship with the network, that it's not like fans of other networks?
I don't think there's any other channel that it's like. I mean, you know, I use this example a lot because I always think it's funny. Like, you ask somebody what they watch on TV, and if they said, "Oh, I love ABC," you'd be like, "What? Like, who talks that way?" Right? Even you wouldn't even say, "I love Showtime." You might love shows on Showtime, right? But we're the only channel, I think, I guess maybe other than, you know, people's choices for news, where they feel like it's part of their identification, right? Part of who they are. Like, you know, we get people getting TCM. Nobody gets an ABC tattoo. Okay. Right. You know, so I think it's a really exceptional relationship. I mean, they are, they love us and they are very tough on us too. I mean, you know, we took on this mantle led by Robert Osborne in 1994, 30 years ago, with being the guardians and the protectors and the celebrators of classic movies. But if we were going to take that role, if we became the guardians of this great legacy of films, then we had to do it right. And so, you know, they're always checking us to make sure we're make sure we're doing it right.
And I assume there's a sense of ownership there, that including what films you show and maybe even hosts, and being comfortable weighing in with their opinion on those things.
They're very comfortable weighing in. And overall, that's come to be good. I mean, in the beginning when I was there, to be honest, when I started 9 years in 2003, so this will be my 21st year at the Net Channel coming up, which is amazing to me. I just never could have imagined that even when I took the job. You know, will you be here in 21 years? I would have thought, no, you move on. They get tired of me, whatever, right? You know, I'm so grateful it worked out as it did. And off the bat, you know, thank goodness there wasn't really social media when I started in 2003, or not the way it is now. I mean, if there'd been Twitter and I could have seen how much people hated me when I started, but I now know what they hated most. But the message board. So anyway, I read the message boards and they were tough, man. It was largely the same people, like seven or eight people who sort of led these conversations about what a doofus I was. but I've learned now that what that is that this channel, the fans of it, understandably, and we experienced it last year when we got all this press that, you know, wasn't all correct, but it was all in our defense, which was super nice. But they don't like change. Right. I mean, you look at it, these are people who, you know, sort of really, I'm one of them. Nostalgia is a big part of their lives and the nostalgia for these movies and nostalgia. I grew up thinking nostalgia was sort of like, you know, being sold something, you know, something made to look retro that you didn't really need. Right. You know, and that it was, but it's not, it's an emotion. Or at least it triggers emotions. And so, you know, obviously when they see somebody new show up on the network or they see some movies that seem more modern than they expected, there's a sense of, is the TCM I love, is the thing that's such an important part of my life, is it going away? And they want some reassurance. So the initial response to that is often more negative than it needs to be. And then over time they realize, oh no, they're still doing what they do. They're just showing a couple of actually pretty good and interesting movies from the 1980s or 90s. You know, our programming hasn't actually changed that much in 30 years. The percentage of movies that we show from our wheelhouse, which is really like, you know, say the advent of sound in the late 20s to the end of the studio era, like 1929 to 1959. You know, the percentage of the movies that we show that come from that era really hasn't changed. I mean, it's moved like a couple of percentage points. I don't have the numbers in front of me, but I bet it's gone down from like 79% of our movies to 76% of our movies, 74%. So we're still, you know, we still know what our mission is.
Well, and you mentioned last year there were some concerns in a lot of quarters that things were going to change, that maybe the network was in trouble. And like you said, that wasn't all accurately reported out there. But it had to be reassuring to get such a big help from some of the biggest names in the industry, some major directors coming forward to say, hey, whatever we can do to lend a hand, we're here.
Yeah, I mean, unbelievably reassuring. And of course, I'll mention the directors in a sec. But I mean, just the audience reaction. I mean, it was, it was this sort of yearning, especially in this divisive time that we're in, and not just divisive politically, but I never know whether I should say divisive or divisive. But I think divisive, which is, I imagine, what the English say, I think it sounds better. I always feel like 4% smarter when I say divisive.
Well, there's no question. Well, and if you're doing math, you don't do long division. You do long division. So.
Don't do long division. I'm going to use that. Yeah. But I just want people to know that every time I say it, I think, is this how I should say this? In the times that we're in, and not just politically, but where maybe it's coming out of COVID, maybe it's just the nature of how we go about our lives. I mean, I just ordered food instead of going out and getting it and, you know, having some interaction with the people at the Jersey Mike's counter. We're more isolated, we're more alone, and TCM was this really important thing to people, right? And they form a community of people who love these movies. You know, when they meet their brothers and sisters and other people at our cruise or at our festival, you know, they form these bonds and it matters. So the notion that right or wrong, as it turned out, that was really in jeopardy. It was really nice to have that outpouring of support. And then, as you alluded to there, Rich, the so many of the biggest names, led by Steven Spielberg, Paul Thomas Anderson, Martin Scorsese, but so many filmmakers and actors, producers, stepped up, showed up for us, and have continued to do so. Like, you know, the word got out, like, if you have some influence in this town, in Hollywood, or in this business of making movies now, or television, certainly great television too, and you love TCM, that's not enough to love it. Like, when they ask you to come on the air, go. You have to come out for us. And of course, people want to, because in the end, with these conversations that they have, you know, they're about movies. So movies that maybe they made, but movies that matter to them, movies that influence them. It's been really lovely, and that's an understatement, but moving even to see how people have come out for us.
We're talking with Ben Mankiewicz here on Downtown. I want to talk a little bit about your background. I think most people know about your family's history. I was surprised to learn that your grandfather, Herman Mankiewicz, maybe didn't view screenwriting as a truly noble profession.
Yeah, it's true. I think you got to, you know, if you saw the movie Mank, I think you got a really good, some of the things in Mank, they didn't have to be accurate. So I'm not criticizing. I loved the movie, loved it, loved what David Fincher did. Mank came out, I think, in 2021. Mm-hmm. Got a bunch of Oscar nominations, 1, 2. It was really about my grandfather and the writing of Citizen Kane. And the movie won more Oscars than Citizen Kane, which will always be a fun little trivia question. What Fincher really got right, and again, every time you say that, it sounds like I'm in the middle of criticizing it. I think it was a really wonderful movie, and, you know, what he got right is the most important thing was the Herman, like who he was, how he acted, what was important to him, right? And you get from the movie that what was important to him were big ideas, politics, the war, the world, and World War II, when I say the war. And the movies were not, my father always said that the one thing you really weren't allowed to talk about, there was no official rule, but one thing no one ever talked about at dinner or breakfast or any meal that they had together, whether it was a dinner party and other sort of screenwriters and artists were there, were the movies. That was just not an interesting conversation to Herman or to my grandmother, Sarah. And Sarah, I knew very well. She died when I was 18 or 19 and 18. And Herman died long before I was born. But he just, you know, his father had been a professor in New York at CCNY, had come over as an immigrant from somewhere on the German-Polish border. And, you know, he was very highbrow, there was not a lot of praise that went out to these kids, Herman and Joe Mankiewicz, his brother, who eventually won four Oscars, raised in Pennsylvania before they moved to New York. They were expected to be smart. They were expected to read. They were expected to read great literature, understand it. So jobs that were acceptable to Herman, as I think came down from his father, Franz, were, you know, you write the great American novel, write a theater, write a play. That was serious work. Being a theater critic was serious work. Being a professor was the most serious work. He really pushed Joe, who was a great student, you know, to be a professor. Always thought that he would be a teacher, would, you know, get a PhD and would teach it in college like he did. And the movies at that time, you know, as they emerged in the teens to Franz Mankiewicz and a young Herman Mankiewicz, this was to them, you know, filler popcorn for the masses, right? And I know that sounds elitist, but I think they were elitists. fun elitists, but and so that got down to Herman, and that's the tragedy of it, because every other screenwriter in the 1930s in Hollywood, my sense is, he asked who's the best of us, they would have said Herman, who's the smartest, who's the funniest. And, you know, yeah, some of the movie is filler for the masses, but that's okay, we're all in the masses, we need filler. I'm desperate for filler. So, you know, I, if I could go back in time, I always say that that's really what if I could make a difference to something in my family, and I'd go back to Herman and be like, no, this matters. This is important. It's not, you don't have to take a backseat to playwrights. Like, this is what you're doing matters. And these movies are going to matter.
Your father, Frank, a giant in the political world, working with George McGovern, with the real RFK.
That's right.
So you had these vast experiences and topics that were clearly of passion to you. But what chose you to move into the world of broadcast journalism to begin your career?
Well, my brother Josh is a correspondent, Dateline NBC. He's been there for close to 30 years now, and but he's been a reporter. He's older than I am. He's 12 years older, and so he. It's just the two of us, but he was always this, still is this, you know, really outsized presence in my life. I mean, he fills it nicely. He's a great, great, great big brother. And, you know, at some point, I don't know when, I don't know if it happened in a day or over some time, my father, like my grandfather, my father was considered by everybody who knew him to be the smartest guy in the room, often the funniest, the cleverest, the person you talked to when you were in trouble, person you wanted to share things with when things were going well, person whose take you wanted on anything important going on, whether it was business, politics. And, you know, my dad had, I mean, he beat the Nazis. He grew up in Hollywood and then, you know, enlisted and fought and served, arrived in Europe in combat in the end of 1944, and served really, you know, fighting his way through the end of the war in Europe in 1945. And came back, and then he was a journalist, and then he, when John F. Kennedy was elected, and said, you know, ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country. My dad was a lawyer. He'd become a lawyer, and he didn't like it here in L.A. And he joined the Peace Corps, became Latin American director of the Peace Corps, lived in Peru with my mom and my brothers before I was born, and they you know, made a difference. That was the beginning of the Peace Corps. And then got hired by Robert Kennedy while he was in the Peace Corps. That's where they met. Bobby was impressed with him. He became his press secretary in the Senate and then the presidential campaign. And then was a reporter briefly in Washington. And then George McGovern, he just led this big, big, eventually president of National Public Radio. He led this big life. And I realized, I'm not going to do this. Like, I can't do these things that he had. I'm not as well read. I mean, this guy, my dad, would answer every question right on Jeopardy. You know, was a huge sports fan, got me to be a sports fan. I mean, we'd gamble when I was a kid on football games on Sunday, and he'd watch the St. Louis Cardinals every day in the summer in baseball. And then he led a class among all these other smart people. He taught a class of just group of friends in D.C. for 20 years on James Joyce. Like at some point you're like, I'm not going to be doing that. Like, I am not going to just read James Joyce because I, you know, he took courses at UCLA and Joyce and loved him. And so you just realize I'm not as smart as my father. You know, I'm not going to lead as big a life. I'm not going to have an impact on as many people. And I can let that stress me out. There is some stress in being a banker. It's just that you won't be as clever and smart and successful as some of the people who came before. Mostly it's good. You know, I mean, it's opened some doors for me. It's no question. But there's a burden that carries. And I just sort of decided, I don't really want that to be a burden. Like it shouldn't be, it should only be a blessing. And it's okay. I could still have a really nice life just because I'm not as smart as my father. I wish Herman had had that. That would have helped him be like, you know what? I don't need to impress this guy. He doesn't get it. So anyway, that was, you know, it was so. But anyway, the result of that was probably following in my brother's footsteps seemed easier and more attainable. And, you know, I really, if my brother did it, then I just wanted to do it. He was so smart, still is so smart, so funny, so kind. And, you know, really, you know, he told me how to write a news story. He told me how to do a stand up for TV. You know, he taught me how to shave. He taught me how to shampoo. I mean, literally, every time I take a shower, every time I still think of him at 5 years old telling me how much shampoo to use. Right. You know, it's still made it. And every time I shave, I'm like, oh, you don't want to go against the grain first. You want to, like, it's so, you know, so he was a reporter. And so I gave it a shot. I was very shy. So it took a little, I sort of thought that was a way that might draw me out of my shyness, sort of force myself to do something in front of people. Which was always super hard for me. Still seems counterintuitive to me to not be shy.
You didn't like local news, right? And I worked in local news a little bit back early in my young man days. And I always look back at the time when local news stations got trucks that enabled them to go live every night. And then you had to justify the expense of that live truck. And so anything flashy became the lead. What drove you out of local news?
Well, I mean, one, anything flashy became the lead, and anything not, if there wasn't anything flashy, you had to make it flashy. That's where the real danger is, right? If it was legitimately flashy, okay, but you'd end up turning things flashy. I covered one story in Charleston, South Carolina, which I loved, and this ended well, but you know, normally you lost these arguments, but I was the education reporter, which was a big beat in Charleston, because the biggest political fights that we had down there, and I was there 93 to 98. The biggest political fights were school related when they tried to, you know, get textbooks stopped or, you know, there was one guy there who liked me, a guy named John Graham Altman, who was a racist, and he was on the school board, and he would every year he would propose that March be White History Month. It was only fair after Black History Month. And that would always garner. So there was always this tension at the school board, and they had a sort of a thoughtful, serious person leading the school board who had to deal with all this junk. And it made for good news stories. So one day I get a call in the morning before I come in because the buses roll early, and the news director, a guy named Don Feldman, who put me on the air, who's as responsible for my career as anybody. I went down there as a producer, and he said he put me on inside of a year. He put me on in 5 or 6 weeks. I just drove down and got a job. Like I drove down, I rented a car, drove down, had a tape from journalism school and from working as a sports producer in Washington. Anyway, so I go down there and I've been the education reporter for a year or so. And he says, there was a race riot. He calls me, said, I've got a tip. There's a race riot on a school bus. That's how it was portrayed to me. I'm like, where? He's like, somewhere west of the Ashley, which is a part of Charleston. But I don't know where. He's got to go figure it out. Like, go figure it out. Talk to bus drivers. Find them. Talk. So I go over there, you know, whatever. Call some people I knew. Anyway, and eventually, I think somewhat lucky, I tracked down me and the other producer. We tracked down the bus driver. I go, hey, I know there was a riot this morning. And he was like, a riot? I'm like, yeah, a race riot. He goes, I drive 6-year-olds. Right. And I was like, oh. I go, what happened? He goes, well, this black kid and the white kid, they definitely got into a fight on the bus, but they're friends. And they were not fighting when they got off the bus. They're still friends. But yeah, they swung some punches. I had to pull over and stop the fight. You know, I'm like, but there was no name call. He goes, I honestly don't know what they called him, but they were fighting to break up the fight. The other kids were reacting. It was dangerous. Anyway, they weren't fighting. I'm telling you, they're friends, and they got off the bus together, like laughing, their boys. And I called the news director, and I'm like, there's nothing here, you know, or maybe I went back because it was 95. I don't know if we even had a phone, or I went to a payphone, probably called. I'm like, there's no story here. It's just this. And he's like, well, we've already cut a promo. So we got to do it. I go, but it wasn't the race riot. It was the six-year-olds fighting. I don't want to do a story on six-year-olds fighting. And he says, we already cut a promo. You got to do a story. And then I got back, as I recall, and I'm like, Don, this isn't a story. This is a mistake. This is stupid. And to his credit, he was like, all right, we'll pull the promo. We'll run something else. But that was sort of what you were up against and what I was up against. And that is ultimately the kind of thing that made me stop wanting to do news.
Yeah, am I right in understanding?
On television, by right. The way. And print journalism, there's still some good at stuff, but it's, you know, those, I mean, how many jobs would I have lost if I'd been a print journalist by now? You know, it's such a hard way to make a living, which is a tragedy.
Am I right that the job that you auditioned for at TCM was not actually the job that you got?
Yeah. You know, there's a couple of people there who don't believe me. Even who were there then. Yeah. The job that they initially conceived or that I auditioned for was that Robert Osborne was doing the hosting 7 days a week, and they had 7 nights a week, and they had learned that there was a big audience. They'd done a little more. We don't get ratings at TCM because we don't have commercials, never will. And we learned that there was a big audience Saturday and Sunday during the day. So they thought, let's get another host to take some of this burden off Robert, even though he didn't host then, but we need a second host to do things. And we'll just do it on the weekends during the day. And they thought, what we'll do is, instead of just being like, Robert, this will be conversations, that they'll hire this host, and then I'll do an interview. I'll do these three movies, and, you know, with John Ford's grandson, Dan Ford, and we'll talk about Ford movies and do things like that. So they bring me in, and a lot of people who would be recognizable, at least around LA. Some people got commercial jobs, a couple actors. And they had us watch the Seven Samurai, the Kurosawa movie, and the Magnificent Seven, the John Sturges Western remake of the Kurosawa movie, although the Kurosawa movie was a salute to John Ford Westerns. So those two movies, and we watched those movies and discussed them, and they would have all the people who were there for the audition. There were like eight of us. One of us would be the host and two people would be the experts, and they'd switch it up. And I spent the whole day. That audition must have lasted 4 hours. I'd never been in an audition that lasted that long. They're all super quick and they're super brutal auditioning for jobs. And this one was great. You had to watch these movies and know something about them. And they kept asking me to stay and like, okay, now you're the host. Now you're the expert. Now come be the host with these two people. Now be the host with these two people. And I was like, I'm doing well. They like me. These conversations are going well. And it was sort of what I did, what I hoped then to be good at, what I hope I have gotten good at. So I did that, and then I wrapped it up, and then I didn't hear anything from them for 2 or 3 months, though they said I was definitely in the running. And by the time I called back like 2 or 3 months later, they had abandoned that whole idea because it was going to be too hard to book on a regular weekly basis. And they're like, no, we'll just have movies intro Saturday like Robert Osborne does. And so by the time I came back, that was the job. And then I got a script that they wanted me to read for The Bishop's Wife. I don't think I changed a word. I read it off a teleprompter. It's not hard to read a teleprompter. Some people can't do it. It's a skill. It's a weird skill, but it's not an important skill. And it's not a skill that suggests any kind of talent either, reading aloud. But I, you know, did that. And like, I wrapped it up in the first take. And then the guy goes, oh, well, this is not your first barbecue. A phrase I hadn't heard. I'd heard rodeo. I hadn't heard barbecue. And I was like, no, I read all the time. and I got the job. So stupid. Yeah. So it was, you know, but if they hadn't had that initial way of doing it, I don't think I would have shined in the audition as much as I did. So I got that. That was super, super. That felt very lucky, very fortunate.
Did it take a while for Robert Osborne to warm up to you?
Definitely. The good news for him is that he didn't have to. You know, he lived in New York and shot in Atlanta, and I live in Los Angeles and shot in Atlanta. And we worked with the exact same people, but we were never there at the same time. You know, it was like it was like the State of the Union, one member of the cabinet. We just couldn't be there because we only had access to one studio. So we literally, if Robert was shooting, I couldn't shoot. If I was shooting, he couldn't shoot. But I worked with all these people who worked with him, hair and makeup, wardrobe, producers, directors, the lighting technicians, like all the people who make TCM really what it is. And to a person, I mean, without, I'm not overstating this at all. Everybody liked it, loved him. He didn't love me, but he didn't know me. He just, I think, didn't like that, he was then in his upper 60s, maybe 70 at that point. And that there was this, young kid coming in who definitely didn't know as much as he did. And there was, some focus and attention on this new host, and he wasn't part of that process. And I've now experienced that, like being the veteran host, and now we've got four other hosts, and I hate all of them.
Yeah. Right? Especially Dave Karger, right? My God.
I can't stand. I hate Eddie the most, and then I hate Dave Karger. So I get it. And so I did. And by the way, Robert totally warmed to me, and we had really connected significantly, by the time of our 20th anniversary in 2004. He was always nice to me, by the way. I don't want to suggest otherwise. The few times that we would see each other, the cruise or the festival, or sometimes we had these corporate retreats, like the first 2 years I was there. But when I then became the veteran, and then they hire these other hosts and they focus some attention on them, and you're like, hey, what about me? But I was determined to make sure that those guys felt super accepted, and it was very easy because Alicia, Jacqueline, and Dave and Eddie, I mean, they're so smart, and they're good at what they do, and I think we all do it a little bit differently. You can't try to be. I learned that too. I mean, I can't try to be Robert Osborne because I would fall so clearly short. I have to do it. I was only good at anything on the air. I learned even in Charleston, and then when I was in Miami. You can't be anything but yourself. There are times when I was on the air that I felt like I was playing a person on the air. Like I'd be anchoring the news and I would think I'm anchoring the news in a movie. I'm laughing at things that aren't funny. I'm introducing people as if we're in the middle of a joke, Joining us now, Sherry, how's the weather? Sherry, how's our Sunday looking? And you're like, what am I doing? Why am I talking about this? This is so, inauthentic. So by the time I got to TCM, I sort of thought, look, man, people might hate me, but I got to at least try and be as much myself here as I possibly can, which is hard to do on television with lights and makeup. Mm-hmm. It takes a bit to figure out your way to be yourself.
How often do you go to Atlanta?
Basically once a month. I mean, right now it's slightly less. Instead of 12 or 13 times a year, I probably go 9 or 10. That's just because of the nature of how production is and filling the days a little more than we used to. But I go, I've gone to Atlanta. This will be the next trip I make. I think it'll be my 183rd shoot, something like that. 183rd formal shoot. I've probably had 8 or 9 other fill-in things. So I've probably gone close to 200 times, at least part of a week, at least 3 or 4 nights, usually 5 nights.
And obviously you've got writers, but you have to be involved in that because that authenticity, you've got to find your own voice, and nobody does that better than you.
Oh yeah. That's what I spend more time on, is the writing of those scripts. And I don't even take the first pass at them, but copy editing them, changing them, moving things around. It takes a lot of time, and then putting them in the right, making sure it's my voice. As time has gone on, they've gotten better at that. But even some, when they try and, this is the kind of thing Ben would say, it's always slightly, not always, but it's often off a little bit because I'm the only one who can really sort of do that authentically. So yeah, I sort of make them mine.
There's a willful suspension of disbelief that goes with being a viewer too. And the other night I was watching with Patty Jenkins on, and I understand how it works being in the business, but at the same time, at least half of me was convinced that you and Patty Jenkins were sitting back watching The Fisher King while I was watching. And to me, that's a skill to be able to get that out there in some way.
Yeah. I mean, it's a trick. It's all a trick. I mean, your favorite show, whatever you watch, is a trick. I did an episode of Big Love, the HBO show with Bill Paxton. who was a really lovely guy and a really big supporter of TCM. And I'd watched the show. I wasn't a huge fan of it, but I watched it pretty regularly. It was good. And there were three houses in the, you know, it was like the, about the multiple marriages, about the polygamy. And so and he had his three wives live next to each other, and they had a kind of a shared backyard. And so I go do the show, and I was a newspaper. I was like a TV reporter. That's all I've ever played. And some version of myself. And then I get there, and those houses, aside from being fake houses, you know, and it was like in Santa Clarita, and they being about an hour outside of LA, more or less. And they're all, it's indoors. It's not even outdoors, those backyards. And I was like, no way. Right. I mean, I still get dazzled. I get dazzled by it all the time. I did an episode of the Apple show Sugar, like 6 months ago. I think I know it just aired. And like, I just couldn't believe what they do to create these moments. So yeah, that's part of what we do is create that. But the whole key to it is in the conversation. It's just get making the conversation as authentic as possible. And the fact that, you know, this guest almost always does it. And I always do, whether I know the movie well or not, I make sure I just saw it recently. So at least the feeling of talking about it, because you give me, if I haven't seen a movie, even, you know, if it's been a week, I start to lose the ability to talk about it in the easy way that I want to in that moment. So you just, you cheat it a little, but you make it as genuine as possible.
The plot thickens is so terrific. We had Peter Bogdanovich on the show, and we dipped our toes into his incredible life and some of those stories. But that first season, it was so powerful and wonderful, and he was so honest and upfront with you and shared stories that didn't always put him in a great light, but it was such a wonderful exploration of a talented life.
I loved Peter. I still love him. I mean, I can't believe he's gone. And just because he became such an important part of my life pretty quickly. I think it's in I know it's in one of the episodes. You know, when I first met him, he had this reputation, a good reputation at that point for being, I still think it's true. I mean, he's the only person who I think, you know, like Mel Brooks, Peter Bogdanovich, and Robert Osborne, and probably Martin Scorsese, but that's the pantheon of people who know stuff about classic movies. Yeah. They know everything. Peter knew everything. And such a great storyteller. So I was just intimidated that he was going to, you know, see me for the fraud that I am. I met him at a hotel. We're in Toronto. We're going to do a little publicity for the festival. We're going to do a screening of the Last Picture Show at a great old theater in Toronto, which is a great city. And I went to meet him in the hotel bar, and I was like, this is going to be bad. This is going to be bad. It's Peter Bogdanovich. And he had a cold, and a pretty bad cold. And so he was like sipping tea, and his voice was nasally. And he was like, you know, he was like here, and he was going to do it because he committed to it, but he clearly wanted to be resting. And he was just, it humanized him instantly. And I was like, one of the first things I said to him, and I remembered this much later, I should have put this in the podcast, but I said to him, I'm sorry for you, but I'm so glad you have a cold. I go, because you just, all of us, and he laughed like that right away. And he was like, because you're like, it's okay. You get colds. Peter Bogdanovich gets a cold. Like, maybe I don't need to be as intimidated by you as I am. And he was, so we just kicked our friendship formed there. Sybil Shepherd called him a couple of times. And we were only together at that point, like 8 hours. And she kept calling. They weren't even there. They weren't romantically linked at all. She was married, I think, at that point. But she was worried about him because he was traveling and had a cold. Peter has that effect on people who he met, like people, even exes, like they stayed in his life. And he'd had all this. He was clearly arrogant and a pain in the ass and difficult to deal with, maybe even difficult to be around for a time in the 70s. After he made these three incredible movies to launch his career. They were his second, third, and fourth movies. Last Picture Show, What's Up, Doc, Paper Moon, three straight years. 72, 73, 74, do I have that right? Or 71, 71, 72, 73. He'd made a wonderful movie called Targets a few years earlier. Roger Corman, the late Roger Corman, sort of put him on to. Targets is also an excellent movie. But those three were amazing. And You know, and he believed his press, and he was a pain in the ass. He's very handsome. He won Sybil Shepherd over and left his wife to be with Sybil. He was very arrogant. And then all these terrible things happened to him. And some of which were his doing, but most had nothing to do. It was just terrible, unfortunate events, including the murder of a woman he loved dearly, and Dorothy Stratton. So he got humbled, and he screwed up his career after that. And he bought back the rights to the movie he wanted to be made with Dorothy. And he lost a gazillion dollars and sort of became a pariah around town. And it changed him. And it made him a really compelling figure to talk to, I think, because he understood, you know, he still had the thing that made him arrogant, but he was humbled by it and he understood it. So he was really interested in what other people had to say and what other people thought. It was a wonderful subject for the first season of The Plot Thickens. We're about to have our fifth season.
Can't wait for it to learn even more about Portland, Maine's own John Ford.
That's right. Portland, Maine's own John Ford. That's right. It's going to be a really good season. I'm very anxious to bring it to you. Most of the episodes are already done, but we're still tinkering.
And I love the Talking Pictures podcast, man. The Mel Brooks conversation that should be in the museum of filmmaking. It was such a wonderful conversation.
Thanks for saying that. It was tricky. And I love Mel also. And by the way, Peter and Mel both say the same thing about Madeline Kahn. They both said almost the exact same words to me at various times, you know, and Peter worked with her on What's Up, Doc, his third movie. And then he worked and put her in Paper Moon again. And then Mel had seen her in What's Up, Doc, and cast her in Blazing Saddles. And they both said that the one thing about Madeline Kahn, she never, ever understood how funny she was. She never got it. Yeah.
Can we play a short version of a Super 8 that you play on the podcast?
Oh, yeah, sure. We ask these eight questions of every director we talk to, filmmaker. I mean, we would have had actors on, but that was strike. So season two of The Plot Thickens, which we make in cooperation with Max, and you can find on Max or anywhere that you get podcasts, was just me in conversation with, I think, 10 directors over the course of the season, 9 or 10 directors. It was great, a great, great, great experience. I really enjoyed it. We asked these Super 8 questions. These 8 questions went to every single person.
Well, we'll call this the Funky Four. How about that?
Sure.
Let's see. Is there a film that you always stop and watch if you're channel surfing? Oh, there it is, and you're in for the next 2 hours.
Well, as you know, channel surfing has largely gone away, which is a weird thing to go away because it was such an important part of my life, right? And I'm sure yours and so many people's, but I don't have standard cable anymore. And even when I did, you don't really surf. You know, the according to IMDb, the best movie ever made is Shawshank Redemption. I'm actually going to host a Q&A with a bunch of the cast at the 30th anniversary of Shawshank Redemption in the summer in Mansfield, Ohio, where 90% of the movie was shot. It's where the prison is. They built an alternate prison so they could shoot inside. It's on the location. So Shawshank always did that to me. You know, it's a movie we had it at the festival this year. You know, it's not my favorite movie, but I just, you know, it was a movie that was always on. Mm. And, you know, it was TNT or TBS ran it all the time. And you just, wherever it was, you'd stop. A movie did not do well. It was critically mixed reviews. It didn't make money. And then about when it came out on VHS, that's when they learned everyone is renting this movie. Everyone is renting this movie and everyone loved it. And then it started airing on TV. And now it's, you know, according to IMDb, which is just based on voting of fans, you know, it's better than Casablanca and Citizen Kane and Seven Samurai and both Godfathers. I mean, it's crazy. I love it. So I don't even take much beef with it, but it's I love that movie. I must have 100 movies about which that is true, or was true when you flip channels. And I miss that. I miss finding Casablanca or Midnight Run on the air randomly and just settling in and watching it.
Do you have a guilty pleasure movie?
No, I have. I mean, first of all, I just am in a significant debate with my gambling friends. We talk movies a lot about Unfrosted, the Pop-Tart movie. Like I thought it was going to be terrible, and it was funny. Like, I just liked it. It was fun. So, I mean, I'm filled with guilty pleasure movies and TV shows. I don't know that that counts as a guilty pleasure. I don't want to, you know, I love Jerry Seinfeld, but it seemed like it was going to be stupid. And it was. And it was also incredibly entertaining to me. When you flip channels, I used to watch King of Queens all the time. And I loved the King of Queens. That was a guilty pleasure television show. You know, I like romantic comedies, and they don't have to be that good. I like great ones. Notting Hill is a great one. Mm-hmm. Four Weddings and a Funeral, both Richard Curtis written movies. Those are both great ones. But we showed our daughter, you know, How to Lose a Guy in 10 Days, which is unbelievably predictable and stupid. It's stupid. It's a stupid movie. And I don't care. If it were on right now, I'd probably watch it. And I look at Kate Hudson every time she makes a face or smiles at her. I'm like, I love Kate Hudson. You know, I don't know Kate Hudson, but I imagine I'd be pretty impressed with her if I met her in person. So, you know, that's the thing about talent like that, of Matthew McConaughey too. And Kate Hudson, man, they just turned something that, but I mean, guilty pleasure. I must have 1,000 guilty pleasure movies.
All right. What's a movie that always brings back a childhood memories for you?
You know, sometimes that can be a movie that wasn't even good. Like, my father, the first movie I remember seeing with my father and my brother together was the remake of The Champ with Rick Schroeder, then Ricky Schroeder and John Boyd.
Yeah.
You know, Wallace Beery won an Oscar for the original. And the remake's terrible. It's terrible. And it's super sad. But it came out, I don't know, I want to say when I was 8 or 9, 76. I think it was 79. I think I'm actually later. So maybe my memory's wrong. But I remember seeing the three of them. I don't know that I'd seen a movie with the two of them. And I just remember that we all hated it. But if I saw it on now, I'd watch it just because it brings back those memories. And I remember the theater. I remember where we were. I remember what it smelled like. I remember the look on my brother's face after the movie, the kind of like, ugh, that was rough, you know? I can't believe he dies in the end. It's a spoiler. You shouldn't even see it.
Right now.
So that's the great thing about movies is they often bring back those memories.
And what's a movie that you love to introduce to people who haven't seen it?
Oh, well, there's so many of those. I mean, but, you know, there's these, all these movies from, you know, that we, Peter Bogdanovich, just get back to that, was the first person to point this out to me. He would always say that 1939, you know, which generally considered Hollywood's greatest year, it's the year of Gone with the Wind and The Wizard of Oz and so many other great movies, Stagecoach, Menachka. And he would say that was routinely referred to as Hollywood's best year. He was like 1940 and 41 were better, and probably 42, which was Casablanca at the end of 42. And so to me, 1957 is Hollywood's greatest year. And so I love sort of pointing that out to people. I do it in a lot of scripts, but Paths of Glory might be my favorite movie. A Face in the Crowd might also be my favorite movie. Unless it's 12 Angry Men, which could arguably be my favorite movie, or Sweet Smell of Success. And I just, those four movies right there, and I haven't even named the one that won Best Picture, which is this grand epic Bridge on the River Kwai. So, Bridge over the River Kwai. So the, you know, and Desk Set, first time we saw Spencer Tracy and Katharine Hepburn in color, and some great foreign films too. So an amazing year.
All right, before we let you go, what's the future of cinema? We had the director Ed Zwick on a few weeks ago, and he was saying that it has accelerated here in the post-COVID era. Will there always be a place for, I guess, what I would call grown-up films, films about real people?
Yeah, I think that most of those are on television now, right? I mean, that's mm-hmm. where those writers are now, you know, in the debate we have over superhero movies, and I'm on, you know, I'm not on Martin Scorsese's side, but I understand what he's saying, and I also understand the response to it. I was just reading something from Chris Hemsworth yesterday, you know, like those movies brought people into theaters, so yeah. we can't do this both ways. We can't bemoan that nobody's going to the theaters and then say we can't make the movies that bring people to theaters. I was bummed out that The Fall Guy, which is really good, like didn't do better, you know, but so I don't know what the future holds. Obviously, we're just got to get used to, we're going to see a lot of stuff on our own screens at home, and these screens will get bigger and you know, it'll hopefully feel like more of a moment, but going out to a movie is special. So it'll stay. Obviously some theaters have closed. I don't think they're coming back. But there are going to be movies, the Barbie Oppenheimer phenomenon was not a one-off. They'll do it again. I'm a big believer in the creativity of these people who make movies. And I think that they'll continue to make compelling stories. I hope there are more stories that are, that feel like prestige television, which is what's the stuff that's written for adults. And you mentioned that you had Ed Zwick on, who I know has a book out, and Ed, in the conversations about prestige television. In many ways to me, it started with the Sopranos, the new wave of it with these anti-heroes, but you could go back and say that certainly the Stephen Bochco shows and Hill Street Blues and L.A. Law were big parts of the beginning of prestige television in the 80s. But so was 30-something, which I always sensed. I was like, this is not like these other shows. This is super grown up. And he captured an office, an advertising office, Ed Zwick and Marshall Herskowitz did, about, where Miles Trentell did his work, where those guys, the two main guys, Tim Busfield and Ken Olin, where they worked. Like, I just don't know that anything was better workplace still than what was on 30-something. And I don't think I've seen an episode of 30-something in 30 years, at least more.
Ben, it's great to talk with you. Thanks so much for making time for us today. We wish you and everybody at TCM a happy 30th anniversary, and keep on doing the great work you do.
Hey, thanks so much. It's a pleasure to talk to you. I'll come on anytime. Thanks. Great.